Hello and a very warm welcome to Midori House from Studio One here at Monocle 24 with me, Ted Kravitz. In the next hour, we'll be heading over to a chilly Milan to get a behind-the-scenes preview from the newest issue of our winter newspaper, Alpino. We also have a report on how an art gallery has given the New York Metropolitan Opera a surprising boost.
I just remember saying something like, if you give me a space, I'll do it. And he said, just come on in, I've got an idea, take a look at it, see if you like it.
And we'll be joined in the studio by Monocle's foreign editor Steve Bloomfield, who'll be rounding up his choice of the year's news events. All that, plus some great music, right here in the next 60 minutes on Midori House. But first, let's get the latest news from around the world.
It's 3 a.m. in Tokyo, 1900 hours in Vienna, 1800 here at Midori House in London, and 10 a.m. in Los Angeles. You're listening to Monocle 24 News with Barney Burnham. Britain's Prime Minister David Cameron defended his decision to break with European partners by vetoing a change to the EU treaty today, insisting that remaining a member of the 27-nation bloc was in Britain's national interest. In a noisy debate on last week's European summit, he told the House of Commons that Britain remains a full member of the EU and the events of the last week do nothing to change that. He added that membership of the EU is vital to Britain's national interest, as Britain is a trading nation which needs the single market for trade, investment and jobs. And he said that he went to last week's summit genuinely seeking agreement.
But frankly, I have to tell the House, the choice was a treaty without proper safeguards or no treaty. And the right answer was no treaty.
Rival militias in an area southwest of the Libyan capital exchanged heavy gunfire today after a dispute flared up between them that local residents said had killed at least four people over the last 48 hours. Journalists in Wabis, about 190 kilometres from Tripoli, said the fighting was between members of the El Mashasha tribe based around the town and fighters from the larger town of Zintan in the mountains to the north. Shots, including those from machine guns, could be heard, and all men and boys in Wabis were carrying Kalashnikov rifles, the journalists said. Demonstrations staged in Moscow and across Russia over the weekend were a good sign for democracy in that country because the Russian government allowed them to go ahead, according to the White House. White House Press Secretary Jay Carney told reporters that Russian government authorities allowed the demonstrations to take place. It's a very positive sign to all those who support the democratic process. Oil prices fell today in choppy trading, pressured by concerns that Europe's agreement on closer fiscal union will not solve its debt crisis and might deepen a regional slowdown. The euro, stock markets and gold all tumbled, while the dollar, German bund futures and US treasuries, seen as a safe haven from the highly indebted eurozone governments, rose. The storming of the British embassy in Tehran last month wasn't a planned attack, but the result of an explosion of anger at London's meddling in Iranian affairs, a group that claimed responsibility for the incident said today. One of the representatives of the so-called British spy Ness Pickett's Council said the intention had been to protest in front of the British mission and stage a mock arrest of the ambassador. This year's Nobel Peace Prize laureates Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, Leymar Gbowee and Tuachol Karman met the Swedish Prime Minister Fredrik Reinfeldt today and retreated to a traditional Christmas procession. It's a tradition that the Peace Prize winners who receive their award in Oslo in Norway also visit Stockholm, the birthplace of the Swedish dynamite inventor Alfred Nobel, who instituted the prizes. The three women were honoured for what the Nobel Committee calls their non-violent struggle for the safety of women and for women's rights to full participation in peace-building work. Prime Minister Reinfeldt said it's a matter close to his heart.
We've discussed this before, but we've been into details on to actually empower women, which we think it's at the heart of what is needed to be done in the world.
Leading Indian sportsmen say their country should take a stand against the involvement of Dow Chemicals as a sponsor of the 2012 Olympics in London. Dow Chemicals now owns Union Carbide, the company responsible for the 1984 Bhopal disaster in which gas leaked at a chemical plant, killing thousands of people. At a meeting in New Delhi today, a group of India's most famous sporting stars said if their country did nothing, it would legitimise Dow Chemicals' sponsorship of the event. Those are the stories at the top of the hour here at Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, and now a look at the global weather with Thomas Schaffernacker.
In association with Kuoni Travel.
Let's talk about Europe then. The jet stream will be sending stormy weather to Europe again this week. High winds and rain for the UK, France, Germany, almost all week. Starting Monday night in the UK, the weather may become even more stormy by the end of the week. Meanwhile, fabulous weather in Greece and the Aegean Sea. Let's have a look at Tuesday's City Outlook. London first, 8 degrees and some sun and showers after what would have been a very stormy Monday night. Zurich, 3 Celsius, rain here. In Moscow, 0 degrees and cloudy. And in Athens, it's 18 and sunshine all round. And the travel weather, the advice is to make sure you check before you travel for any delays. The storms in Europe this week may become very troublesome for airports. North America now. Sunny skies in many major cities across the central and northeast of the US, and more to come for the mid-Atlantic states through much of the week. However, in California, it's been raining, but the weather should start to improve now. It's Tuesday's City Outlook. In New York City, 8 degrees and sunny. Chicago, 4 degrees and cloudy. In LA, it's 17, but some rain. Vancouver, 2 Celsius and a rain and snow mix. Other world destinations for the next 2 days. Argentina and Buenos Aires, around 25 degrees. A lot of cloud and a chance of thundershowers. In Brazil and Rio, a bit warmer, around 28 Celsius. Sunny, but thundershowers by Wednesday. Closer to the desert now, Abu Dhabi and Dubai, around 25 degrees with lots of sunshine. The usual story here. And in China, Hong Kong, 20 Celsius, dry and mostly sunny weather here. That's all. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, Lagatia.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, Yorkosa.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Broca Jalava.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Well, every day this week on Midori House, we'll be taking a look back at the year's events. Today is world news, and I think it's fair to say 2011 has been a big year for that. From the Arab Spring to the Eurozone crisis, the Japan earthquake to the fall of Gaddafi. It's been 12 months of upheaval and revolution. Joining us in the studio is Monocle's foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, to give us his roundup of the year's events. Steve, what would you say is the standout theme for you from 2011?
Oh, blimey, a standout theme. Change. Huge, enormous, life-changing change that affects everyone and everything and everywhere.
And that started in March, February, March, April with Egypt,
yes,
Bahrain.
I mean, it started... Yeah, I mean, to be honest, it sort of started at the tail end of 2010 when you had the first sort of beginnings of the uprising in Tunisia, and that spread through to mid-January. You had President Ben Ali in Tunisia fleeing, I think, on January the 14th. Mm. That then spread to Egypt, so by January 25th you had the protests starting there. And so the whole Arab Spring, if we want to call it that, the Arab uprisings... have been obviously an enormous part of the news agenda. I think what's been particularly striking from a journalist's point of view is just how much stuff has been going on, which you've needed to cover. It's been a fantastic year for news, but a terrible year for news budgets because everyone blew their budgets by February. I mean, pretty much everyone was covering Tunisia, covering Egypt, then covering Libya, and that was then before March 11th and the earthquake and tsunami in Japan, which again was a huge event that lots of us have sort of not forgotten about, but I think we've forgotten how dangerous everything felt for a few days there, where no one really knew what was happening with those nuclear power stations, and no one really knew what the fallout would be. It was an incredibly dangerous moment for the world.
But isn't that a sign of from news organisations also the necessity of actually being on the ground and how it's expected to be there? You can't get away with actually not sending people anymore. Just what you were saying about the budget.
No, indeed, and I think it's been in that sense it's been quite satisfying to see all these news organisations that had been cutting back, that had been closing down bureaus, pulling journalists out of countries, have now had to be sending people back. It's slightly different for us here in that we've been expanding rather than cutting, but for a lot of other news organisations, they've been pulling back, and this was really not the year to pull back.
And there have been resonances of at least those two stories that we've spoken about so far, haven't they? The Japan earthquake and tsunami. We see resonances even later in the year, trying to get tourists back into the country, and you know, pockets of little radiation crop up here and there in the country, and then extending into Tahrir Square comes back towards December for more protests, and even you know Russia and then Bahrain pops up again.
Exactly. I mean, it's been you know it's been a year of protests, and I think one of the interesting things is how you know in the world we live in right now that the protest in one country can have an effect on a situation in another. We saw it in Egypt. It was, you know, though people in Egypt saw the pictures on mainly on Al Jazeera of the protests in Tunisia. They saw an unpopular president who'd been in charge for more than 20 years, ousted by the people rising up. And they suddenly thought, well, hang on, maybe we can do this too. And you've seen that spread all across. And, you know, after you know, Colonel Gaddafi was killed in Libya, you then saw you know, renewed protests in Yemen. You know, you've seen renewed protests in Syria. These things all, you know, link to each other.
Well, let's cover a couple more foreign stories before we get on some of your maybe choice odd stories of the year. And we've had a few of them as well. As you say, you've already mentioned Libya, but what about Iraq? The end of operations there, and certainly for the Americans, they'll be out by the end of the year, actually by the early months of 2012, won't they?
Yeah, I mean, I think Iraq has been one of those stories that has been sort of slightly ignored by a lot of people because, you know, it hasn't been as fresh and as new as the Arab uprisings. I think, you know, what we've seen in Iraq has been it hasn't seemed to be as dramatic as what's happened elsewhere. Similarly in Afghanistan as well, it's been one of those stories that it's, you know, very easy just to see as a, oh, well, this is just a bit more of the same, you know, things, you know, are progressing the same way they did before. You know, that's not necessarily true, but that's, you know, the way they've been seen, and they haven't been front page stories, you know, week after week in the way that, you know, in 2010 and, you know, the years before that, you know, both those countries, Iraq and Afghanistan, certainly were.
Well, you mentioned Afghanistan. Of course, one of the stories we had was the U.S. raid in Abbottabad, a word that we weren't possibly aware of. You know, where these places, they come up, don't they? You know, the Grozny and places like that. But we now know about Abbottabad.
We do indeed. The place where bin Laden was living quite comfortably and quite happily, it seems. Bin Laden was killed. And, you know, any other year that Osama bin Laden was, you know, killed by US troops, that would have been the big story of the year. And obviously it's still quite big and quite important, but I think it just really sort of helps sum up, you know, how many important, really crucial stories there have been this year that, you know, we've been talking about this for 5 minutes or so, and only now do we mention that bin Laden was killed. You know, huge story, you know, certainly important in the US. Yeah, certain images of it, you know, we'll remember for a long time. In particular, that picture taken inside the, you know, the Situation Room at the White House, where they're all gathered around watching the footage, and Hillary Clinton's got her hand over her mouth. So, you know, some real images to remember. But I mean, oddly, you know, not the biggest story of the year.
Which would have been what, do you think? Eurozone? It's difficult to say, really, because, you know, being based in London, we see the Eurozone crisis as very much something that's engulfing a whole continent. I'm not sure it's really seen that in Sacramento, California, or Melbourne, Australia, particularly.
No, but it will be next year. I mean, I think this is a financial crisis that isn't going away. I'm not convinced that what was agreed over the weekend of, you know, and a couple of days before that is necessarily going to be enough to halt the crisis. There was a very good piece by Paul Krugman in the New York Times about 2 months ago, maybe 6 weeks ago, where he said, "Is it possible to be both bored and scared at the same time?" And he was talking about the Euro crisis, and he's right. It's incredibly boring and it's incredibly scary, and it's only going to get worse in the new year. I mean, I think it's, you know, in some ways you can say yes, if you're in Sacramento or if you're in Brasilia or if you're in Melbourne, maybe it doesn't look like a big crisis right now, but they haven't worked out how to save the euro yet. And until they do, there's the risk that, you know, the whole European economy falls apart and everyone suffers if that happens.
Indeed. I mean, what we're not seeing is any of the sort of panic around that. And you know, you talk about how markets lead these things. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. But what we're seeing is, you know, we're not seeing everybody in Greece cashing in their euros to cash and then banks collapsing. Not yet, at least.
Not yet.
Yeah. You think it's going to get worse in 2012?
Yeah.
Seems to be.
Yeah.
Okay, what about anything else? Let's move to the US. Another strange year for Obama, where you get the feeling that he doesn't really achieve what he wants to achieve, and heading into 2012, an election year.
He's heading to an election year. And it's not necessarily going to be straightforward for him. He's helped in three ways. One, by, you know, the people he's going to be up against. You know, whoever the Republicans choose, they should be beatable for him. Mm. You know, whether it's Romney, whether it's Gingrich, whether it's, you know, someone we haven't even considered yet who may yet still come into the race. Ridiculously unlikely, but still. So he's got that going for him that I think, yeah, they're all beatable. The economy is starting to get a little bit better for him, so that might help him as well. And the other thing is he's taken foreign policy issues off the table. You can't, you know, he was being criticised, you know, unfairly, I think, you know, by Republicans for being, you know, weak and apologising for America, even though no one can actually sort of point out when he's actually made this apology. And yet, you know, he's killed bin Laden, he's bringing troops out of Afghanistan, he's ending operations in Iraq. He can sort of point to these things and say, look, I've done my job here. But yeah, it's been a difficult year for him. And yet, despite that, you know, if you look back on the 3 years of his presidency, he has introduced, you know, universal healthcare. He has, you know, although not saved the US economy, certainly with his stimulus packages prevented it, you know, becoming a proper depression. So I think there are some things he can say, you know, I've achieved a fair bit. And it was those pesky people in Congress who stopped me doing the rest.
Okay. And just wrapping up, would you choose a sort of slightly zany off-the-wall story that captured your eye over the year? Have you got any ideas?
Maybe. Oh, blimey.
Shall I tell you what?
No, go on. You tell me yours.
Well, I'll start with something that we saw quite recently, and that's, is there life out there? I think if you're going to choose a story, you might as well choose a big one.
Yes, why not?
Possibly another planet that displays Earth-like conditions. It's quite warm there, apparently. It's
good.
Called Kepler-22b, and it's part of this Kepler, let's call it an adventure into outer space to other solar systems to find other planets like us. And we never know. You might see in 2012 that we're not alone.
And we'll all head to Kepler-22b.
Once we make a mess of Earth.
Well, yeah,
Earth.
You know, exactly. Well, Why not?
Well, actually, I mean, maybe, you know, you could choose a sort of slightly strange wranglings over the climate change conference in Durban when they seem to agree absolutely nothing apart from what they might argue about for the next 5 years.
Well, exactly, yeah. I mean, as something that's, you know, just happened over the weekend, it's I remember going to one of these, covering one of these climate change talks about 4 years ago now, and remember having something very similar where they were all incredibly pleased with themselves that at the end they'd essentially agreed that at some stage they would agree. And we seem to be at a similar stage now where they've agreed that they will have an agreement by 2015, which will come into effect by 2020. It would involve all of them. But of course, you know,
about
what they're going to agree on. Okay. So we'll see about that one. That's one for 2012, hopefully.
Yeah. Okay. Well, as you say, much going on. Maybe we are better off on Kepler-22b. I'm sure we can broadcast Monocle 24 to Kepler-22b.
I don't see why not.
Might be quite a good
idea.
We
should try that.
We should. Okay, Monocle's foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, thanks very much for joining us. A bit of time for some music now. This is Kelly by When Saints Go Machine. Was When Saints Go Machine and Kelly. Coming up on Midori House, we cross over to New York to hear how some artists are changing the face of opera. Stay with us.
Christmas has come to Midori House. So relax, throw a log on the fire, and curl up to Monocle 24 for the whole winter season.
God jul fra Monocle 24.
Feliz Natal da Monocle 24.
圣诞快乐从 Monocle 24.
Joyeux Noël de la part de Monocle 24.
Både Karachan Kivan og Monocle 24.
Hej, det er Ulla, så er vi Monocle 29.
Monocle 24 より, Merry Christmas.
Frohe Weihnachten von Monocle 24.
Buon Natale da Monocle 24.
Feliz Navidad de Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 より, Merry Christmas.
Hyvää joulua, toivottaa Monocle 24.
Selamat Hari Christmas, daripada Monocle 24.
Καλά Χριστούγεννα από το Monocle 24.
Merry Christmas from all at Monocle 24.
And you're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24. Now, when you think about cutting-edge art and daring programming, opera is probably not the first thing that comes to mind. But in New York, the vaunted Metropolitan Opera is in the midst of an unexpected revival, and not just on the stage. Gallery Met, an art gallery inside the Opera House, has quietly become a must-see venue for painting, sculpture and drawing from both up-and-coming and established artists. Jason Farrago sat down with the director of Gallery Met to discuss how New York's most progressive artists are revitalizing one of the city's oldest institutions.
New York is a town with a gallery opening every night, a place where artists think nothing of colonizing ever more marginal neighborhoods. There is no shortage of novelty here. Yet quietly, one leading artist after another has been presenting work somewhere wholly unexpected, a one-room gallery that makes up for its small size with a very prestigious address. In a jewel box of a space inside the Metropolitan Opera, the city's visual artists are injecting vitality and risk into what for a long time was a bastion of traditionalism. It's called Gallery Met, a new space in a very old institution, and it's an under-the-radar success story. It's the brainchild of Dodi Kazanjian, a stalwart of the New York art scene whose career has taken her everywhere from Vogue to the White House. But as she describes it, the impetus for the space came from Peter Gelb, the Met's modernizing new general manager.
He was very interested in bringing artists into the to figure out a way to do that. And I just remember saying something like, if you give me a space, I'll do it. And he said, just come on in. I've got an idea. Take a look at it. See if you like it. And it was the south lobby of the Metropolitan Opera. And it needed work. Frank Gehry came in. He was a friend and walked in and looked at it and made a couple of suggestions. And then I ended up calling Lindy Roy, the architect, and everything was pro bono and, you know, sort of putting these things together because there was no money to do it. The money needed to go to the opera. So Lindy gave a great face to it. She figured out a door in and it just gave it a kind of identity and branding, which was terrific. But playing with Peter was the important thing because it made everything possible.
Peter Gelb became general manager in 2006 when the Met, once the paramount performing arts institution in the United States, was in the midst of a long, slow decline. Ticket sales were down, patron contributions were down, public visibility was down. The only thing going up was the age of the audience members. Contemporary art was key to showing that the Met was saying, out with the old.
So the idea of the first show, he said, what do you have in mind? And I said, well, why don't we, all operas have heroines. There were six new productions, and so ask them to choose the heroines from those and see what they can come up with new work. And it was fantastic. All the artists I asked wanted to do it, you know, to my surprise. And they were really interested. It wasn't, most of them were not interested and didn't know anything about opera, like Cecily Brown and John Curran and Richard Prince. And one of the things we could do for artists, we can't pay people, but we could give tickets. And I like that, you know, I mean, that means that they're actually going and seeing it.
The programming is now stretching beyond the gallery and onto the facade of the Opera House itself. Lincoln Center, the campus on Manhattan's west side which houses the Met, has always felt like this sort of citadel, this travertine fortress divorced from the fabric of the city. But a years-long redesign by the architects Diller, Scafidio, and Renfro has opened up the plaza, and the Met feels more and more like a part of the neighborhood now. What's most impressive about Gallery Met is that it's never felt like an add-on, as if some old stodgy institution is trying to get with the times. On the contrary, the exhibitions and the operas are speaking directly to one another, on the same register. For that staging of Satyagraha by the American composer Philip Glass, the gallery showcased 40 years of portraits by Chuck Close, the revered painter and printmaker who made his first of 100 images of Glass back in 1964, when both of them were still unknowns. Recently, art took the leading role at the Opera House, when the South African video artist and draftsman William Kentridge convinced the Met to let him produce an early Shostakovich rarity. The opera was the nose, and the sketches and designs for that show went on view not just at Gallery Met, but at the Museum of Modern Art.
And I remember he told me he was looking for somebody, an artist, who could do opera. Peter was talking about a particular opera, but when he got in touch with William, William had another idea in mind, which was The Nose, which turned out to be brilliant. But then, of course, when it came time, when The Nose was done, then it was time, obviously, to do a show with William at the gallery, and he gave incredible drawings from The Nose and a wonderful machine sculpture, incredible, beautiful portrait of Shostakovich, and so original, and then his banner was amazing. He's really unusual. That doesn't come along so often, where you have someone who has that kind of experience, because you just can't start at the Metropolitan Opera that way, without experience.
5 years in, the Met under Gelb is now undertaking its biggest, riskiest project yet, the first new production in decades of Wagner's mammoth Ring Cycle. It's a $16 million gamble led by the Canadian director Robert Lepage, and to accompany the cycle, Kazanjian has programmed 2 years' worth of exhibitions, with one artist responding to each of the cycle's four operas. For the first of them, Das Rheingold, she made a surprising but inspired choice, the Ethiopian-born American painter Julie Maritu.
I thought of Julie because she's an abstract artist, and she's a brilliant abstract artist, and she uses imagery in there that's identifiable, but it's so layered in the way that the ring is, Wagner is layered, and it felt like it was a very comfortable, it could be a wonderful thing if she would do it. And she really got into it, and she had been working at Gemini in Los Angeles. And she began working on this piece that became the main piece in the gallery. It's a huge print that was composed of 12 pieces that all added up to this one incredible rhapsody that was just so symphonic just to look at it. She did it listening to Rheingold.
Up now at the gallery is an exhibition by Peter Doig, the Scottish painter who now lives in Trinidad. Doig's always been interested in cinema, and his exhibition looks not only at Wagner, but at a film adaptation of the same myths by the director Fritz Lang. Doig also designed the poster for the new production of the Third Ring opera, with the word Siegfried in dripping white paint.
He's somebody I've always wanted to work with also, all of these artists who I've asked. And he very nicely said he would, and he has so much else going on with his film club and his shows that he had happening, but he ended up listening again to the music. He ended up finding his own way in again, as all these great artists do. And he watched Die Nibelungen and came at it through the same myth that Wagner was thinking about, but in his own way. And I also love that he had that filmic side to him. Right now, I'm working with Dana Schatz, and her show opens, it's going to be Gata Dammerung, and opens in January, on January 11th. And then all four of them come back in the spring, which will be great, so that if you want to do a whole week of going to the opera, but all banners come back on front of the house, which is fantastic. All four of them will be there. Never done that before, and it'll be great to see those four artists sort of speaking with each other.
It'll be interesting to see how the old guard reacts when they arrive next month for Gute Dämmerung, the grand finale of the Ring Cycle, and they're greeted with paintings by an artist who's only 35. But Gallery Met is testament to something. The boundaries between these worlds are falling, and for a new generation of New Yorkers, the most traditional art form of them all has been reborn. And while it's dangerous to judge these things by the numbers, last month the Met became the city's new number one cultural institution by revenues, increasing its budget by $24 million, while everyone else is cutting back. It's not bad for the guardians of a dying art form. In New York, this is Jason Ferrando. for Monaco 24.
That was Jason Farrago speaking to Dodi Kazanjian, director of Gallery Met at the Metropolitan Opera in New York. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. It's now time for the global news headlines.
I'm Barney Burnham. Prime Minister David Cameron defended his decision to break with European partners by vetoing a change to the EU treaty, insisting today that remaining a member of the 27-nation bloc was in Britain's national interest. Rival militias in an area southwest of the Libyan capital exchanged heavy gunfire today after a dispute flared up between them that local residents said had killed at least four people over the past 48 hours. Demonstrations staged in Moscow and across Russia over the weekend were a good sign for democracy in that country because the Russian government allowed them to go ahead, the White House said on Monday. Oil prices have fallen in choppy trading today, pressured by concerns that Europe's agreement on closer fiscal union won't solve its debt crisis and might deepen a regional slowdown. The storming of the British Embassy in Tehran last month was not a planned attack, but the result of an explosion of anger at London's meddling in Iranian affairs, a group that claimed responsibility for the incident said today. And claims that the 2012 Olympic Games will snarl up London's traffic are as wrong as the doom-laden predictions of the Millennium Bug were, according to Mayor Boris Johnson. Those are the headlines at Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House. Now, throughout the week, we'll be previewing Monocle's winter newspaper, Alpino. Today, we kick things off by talking to Monocle's Milan correspondent, Ivan Carvalho, to get a behind-the-scenes look into how he constructed his article on Campione d'Italia. Firstly, Ivan, thanks very much for joining us. Where is Campione d'Italia, and what makes it special particularly?
Yes, good evening, Ted. It's located just over the border from Italy, about an hour's drive north of Milan. It's in the canton of Ticino, and it's on Lake Lugano. It's a tiny, tiny enclave. We're talking about 2.5 square kilometers, of which about 1.5 kilometers is actually land, and they have a little rectangle of water, which is theirs, on Lake Lugano, and the Swiss have the rest of the lake to themselves.
And you say it's small, but it's popular, and people want to live there. Just outline why that is.
Well, it's an enclave in Switzerland, and it has several agreements with the Swiss in terms of taxes, so that if you're a resident of Campione, you pay tax on only 80% of your income, and you can have 20% of that off. You don't have to pay taxes on. Everyone there earns in Swiss francs, which is quite funny because when I was visiting, going into bars, they do accept the euro. It's okay to bring euros in, but people are paid in francs. Typically, they have their bank accounts. Everything's in Swiss francs. They also pay the VAT for the Switzerland rate, which is only 8%. Now, Italy, it has been 20% for many years, and now recently, because of the economic crisis, they raised it to 21%, and they might be raising it again next year to 22%. Mm. So for some people, if you're buying big ticket items, that might be a very nice advantage to have only have to pay the 8% VAT that the Swiss residents have to pay.
Mm. I mean, in your article, you spoke about how people like the idea, though, of still living in Italy. Is that right? Is that why people want to live there?
Well, it's in what people call locals call the banana belt of Switzerland. It's a mild climate compared to the rest of the country, and of course you do have the Italian culture still. So you can go in there are cafes, so you have the Italian coffee, because a lot of Italians always complain whenever they go abroad, wherever it is really, about the coffee. And the weather is quite temperate there, and you do have the lake, so you have some nice views. I visited the local football club, which, funnily enough, they play in the Swiss League, and they have a beautiful pitch about 300 meters above the town with an amazing view. I mean, it's spectacular. You could, if you were a member of Chelsea or Barcelona, you would probably envy the views that the fans have when they watch the games on the weekends.
Mm. And tell us, who did you interview? What kind of people did you find there?
Well, we ran into, funnily enough, because there's not a lot going on in Campione, we met a lot of police because it's very very quiet, which is also a big attraction because it's very, very safe. We met some of the carabinieri, some of the police officers, one retired policeman who was out taking a morning stroll. The police really, all they have to do is basically walk the kids home after school. We saw there's about 29 police for 1,500 residents. So most of the time they're just keeping tabs on really, really simple things. And there's only one road into the town, and it's sort of a one-way loop. So it's really hard for somebody, an outsider, to get to enter and not be noticed. We did pop into City Hall, and the mayor was there, and it was very, very informal. She invited us up to her office, was showing us some of the books that they have on the town. It's funny. The town was known for many centuries for the stone carvers, these craftsmen who left Campione and went to work on many of the cathedrals, working in marble, designing many of the churches. For example, Milan's famous Duomo Cathedral. Many of these local artisans went there and other churches. And so she was telling us a bit about this history. Of course, nowadays, to make money, because it's such a tiny little community, they have a casino, which, as locals like to joke, it represents 98% of their GDP.
Well, you say, you know, things happen slowly there. I've just noticed on their flag of arms, there's a snail on there. You think that's sort of symbolic of actually the place itself?
We were asking a lot of people about this, and it represents what they were telling me is the snail brings its with its shell, it takes everything with it, and this was a symbol of those artisans who, when they left the little enclave of Campione to go and work on the carving of various statues on churches, they brought their tools, their carving tools, with them, and so that's sort of the symbol. It's funny that the football club has that as their symbol, and I was teasing the coach about this, and saying, yes, sometimes in attack we're a bit slow like the snail, but we're good on defense, he said.
And what about the location? You know, how easy is it to get to Milan or Bologna or any of the sort of economic powerhouse cities of northern Italy?
It's quite easy. I mean, when there's no traffic, Milan is just under an hour. You can go to Malpensa Airport, which is north of Milan, so it's quite easy to access the international airport. Lugano Airport is just across the lake, 20 minutes. Of course, they can do their banking in Lugano, because Lugano, there on the lake, is the third biggest financial center of Switzerland. So for them, there's a lot of services there. There's lots of boutiques. Switzerland, of course, attracts lots of wealthy foreign individuals, and they have a very nice high street. So there's many services they can get just from Lugano, for example.
Mm. And I mean, summing up, would you say that it compares to Monaco? Is it Monaco without the without the cliche people, maybe?
Well, they do have a casino, but I didn't see any Ferraris or famous tennis players when they're on the off season taking up residence there. It's quite interesting. I would say there are certain incentives that it doesn't have compared to say Monaco. The lake is fairly quiet. It's hard to actually move around on the lake because there's no real boat service. I think there's one boat in the morning that takes the high school kids, because there's no high school in the town, over to Lugano. But in the afternoon they come back by the bus over the roadway. There's a roadway that connects both sides of the lake. So it is for many people a bit isolating, and you know, a lot of people prefer to live maybe on the sea if they're going to retire to a sort of an enclave or a tax haven. Even though this is sort of a tax haven of a lesser degree, it's maybe not for everybody. But the mayor did mention that in recent years, a lot of Russians have been inquiring about buying property there,
and turned away.
It's very difficult to buy because of it's a sliver of land, so prices are very, very expensive, much more expensive even than Lugano, just across the lake. So it's tough.
Okay, well, that's great. Ivan, thank you very much for joining us. That's all you need to know about Campione d'Italia. And that was Monocle's Ivan Carvalho. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We'll be back in a moment.
This Christmas, why not give the gift of Monocle? A Monocle subscription spreads happiness and cheer throughout the year. Our special gift subscription is for only the most deserving recipients. The first issue comes hand-wrapped in Monocle design paper, with an accompanying welcome letter which announces your gift, and a personal message should you so wish. Subscribe now and we'll also send the new exclusive tote bag for 2011 for the first few issues. Our 12-month gift subscription costs £80 sterling, including magazine delivery costs to anywhere in the world. The recipient of your gift will receive 10 issues of the magazine and also 12 months access to all of our online content at monocle.com. So whether they've been naughty or nice, why not give them the gift of Monocle?
Time for a little music now, Midori House. This is Rock With You with Seo Jorge. Fantastic. It's Seo Jorge and Almaz and Rock With You here on Midori House on Monocle 24. Now, continuing our Alpino theme, we have a preview of Monocle's newest film, which is all about our latest winter newspaper. You'll find the film itself at monocle.com, but here's a clip to whet your appetite.
The Monocle Alpino newspaper is back to make your days merry and keep your heart warmed over the winter season. The Monocle team travels from Slovenia to Switzerland, Sochi to Gstaad, to bring you reportage, news and musings from the mountains. First, we head to the capital of Slovenia and discover a city with a clear vision and a down-to-earth feel as it finds its way in a post-Soviet and post-Stag Party era. Once the favourite holiday spot of Joseph Stalin, Sochi is the Russian winter resort now gearing up to host the 2014 Winter Olympics. We find out whether it's ready to show its new face to the world. We have 15 essays on wintry themes written by leading writers, scientists and mountaineers. We meet the inspirational entrepreneurs who have made the most of high altitude opportunities, and we profile the companies that tunnel through mountains using big machines that mean big business. In Gstaad, we find a small family-run cinema bringing a welcome dose of culture to the slopes. We climb the snowy hills of Val d'Aosta in Italy, Aspen in the US and Akita in Japan to meet the newspapers keeping their communities in the know. And in the south of France, we warm our hands against the fireplaces designed by a former sculptor in a tiny village in the Cevennes Mountains. And we take a look around three remote residences that we'd like to hide out in for the winter. Three chefs give us their recipes for an alpine feast, and we meet three food producers from some of the colder corners of the world. In the harsh volcanic landscape of southern Iceland, our senior editor watches a search and rescue team made up of local volunteers go about its perilous work. And finally, we bring you the Monocle Field Guide to the various species of human you're likely to meet living and working in the mountains.
So open up another tab and click through to monocle.com to see the Alpino film in all its glory. You're listening to Monocle 24. More music now. This is Moving by the Quiet Nights Orchestra. Quiet Nights Orchestra there and Moving. Now time for a sneak peek of this week's Culture Show with Robert Bound, which airs straight after Midori House. This week is a radio special where Rob and the team scan the globe's airwaves for the world's most interesting radio stations. From a Chinese broadcaster in Finland to a community station in London. In this clip, they beamed into Alaska to crash the breakfast show of Matt Wilson from KSRM Radio on the Kenai Peninsula. Rob started by asking him what they could see out of their studio window.
We're actually located across the street from a farm here on the Kenai Peninsula. The Kenai Peninsula is located about 2.5 hours south of Anchorage, which is the largest city in the state of Alaska. Uh-huh. And right where we're at, we have a farm on the right-hand side of the street, and then just up the road for us is the one of the largest rivers in the state of Alaska, the Kenai River, which hosts the large king salmon fish. And so we have a view of that, plus the view of the farm, and then, of course, just surrounded by mountains, and this time of year, tons of snow on the ground.
And it seems that, you know, the smaller a radio station is, it tends to rely on it, on what it sees out of its window as some of the stuff that ends up on the radio in the small community. Is that true of KSRM?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we are a local company owned by local individuals that started the radio station over 45 years ago. Actually, the owner of the radio station lives in a house out back of the studios. And we are located on one of the large major roads in our area. And so when traffic flow stops or if it gets messed up, we're the first ones on it. And all of our stations, we have five in our group, are all locally run and locally broadcast to serve the about 40,000 people in our area. And, local is what we do 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And we're also the emergency contact point for our area. So anything that breaks here, whether it be an earthquake or a couple years ago, we had one of our volcanoes blow up on us right in our area. The local community depends on us to let them know that's going on because there's no local television. We have one daily newspaper, but when it comes to on-the-spot information, it comes from us.
And a lot of radio stations, big and small, try very hard, well, especially the big ones perhaps, try very hard to have a personality and be part of the community and be a friend to the listener. But you guys really are, aren't you? You're very much part of the community.
Oh, yeah. I mean, whether some of us are part of local service clubs in our community or belong to different school groups and different organizations, a lot of us not only broadcast, you know, on the air, but we also do, one thing that we do is high school sports, where we will go out and we'll broadcast our local basketball games and our different local sporting events that our kids are in. We'll broadcast those events on the radio as well as other different local events, whether it be meetings of our local agencies or government officials. All those different events we broadcast or do reports on, so that not only are we a part of that, but we see these folks at the schools every day. We see them in the grocery stores. We see them, whether it be at one of the coffee shops, we see them all over the place.
So the radio is sort of an extension of the rest of the social life of the town, right?
100%. Yeah. If I say something on the air to reference, last summer I was building a deck on my house and I'd go to the grocery store to buy some milk and the first person that saw me in the store would say, "So how's your deck going?" And I don't know who this person is, but they know everything about me. And then that's an opportunity to open a conversation to meet that person, that listener that you've never met before, and build those relationships with everyone in the community.
We're actually catching you. We're very lucky to catch you halfway through your breakfast show this morning in Alaska. Now, can you tell us what's been on today's show to give us a flavor of the station and what's on?
Today's show has been about some rain that's coming our way, which is horrible this time of year for us. And so we're preparing our listeners to be ready for what they thought was going to be a weekend of snow turning into a weekend of rain. And then another thing that folks really like to is we read the school lunch menu for our listeners so that they know what their kids can get at the school when they reach there if they choose not to bring their own lunch for the day. These little things that we do add just a special touch to our listeners' lives and gives those listeners the opportunity to know what their day is going to be before they ever get started. And we're probably the only market left in our area where our AM station, which is kind of unheard of now, is number one in the market for 45 years. And so we've got listeners who have so many other choices that they can go to and so many other outlets they can go to, but yet they lean on AM radio every single morning before they start their day, before they go to work. And it's very awesome that they're able to do that.
Well, that was culture editor Robert Bound at KSRM Radio in Alaska. And you can hear that and much more straight after Midori House. Well, we're just about out of time for this edition of Midori House. Today's show was produced by Dawn Trump, researched by Hannah Jenkins, and our studio manager was Katie Bilboa. As you've just heard, Robert Bound is here at the top of the hour with this week's first broadcast of The Culture. Our colleagues on the Monocle Daily will be here at 2200 GMT to kick off the day in Asia. But for now, I'm Ted Kravitz. Thanks very much for listening. And here's one last song to play us out. Two Hearts by Kylie.